Ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Jeff Gross Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a phenomenal show. Jeff's guest is Adam Barrist, who's the founder of the Barrist Firm. Jeff, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Joe. Thanks. And welcome, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Absolutely.
And so, having said that, pull that right about there. Yeah. Perfect. You know, lots to talk about, lots going on. We record this show on a Monday, and it airs a week later. So we don't know what the Eagles are going to do, but we can talk a little bit about that and a very interesting new property that Adam just purchased and is moving in. First, Eagles, okay? Now, again, by the time they listen to this, we will have already played Carolina, but there's nothing wrong with talking about Saquon Barkley. Adam and I were talking about Saquon a little bit beforehand, and I had said, you know, very rarely have I ever seen traits like the ones he has. I mean, obviously the Giants, that, you know, for the amount of money that they paid him, I mean, you know, the Eagles paid him. Okay, so what, I think 38, close to 40 million, something like
that?
The
Eagles paid him, and the Giants didn't, and that's the issue.
They should have paid him just not to play for anybody else for that kind of money.
Exactly.
I mean, it's crazy, but I have never seen any, you know, we've seen great running backs, but I've never seen, even at the Hall of Fame level, that combination of traits. You don't normally see that. You see, Barry Sanders, obviously, unbelievable, you know, strong, but mostly moves and quickness and speed. Okay, this guy's got that, and he's strong. I mean, ever see anything like him in an Eagles uniform?
I mean, honestly, no. You know, it's like those old movies that you watch that are not real, and they recreate scenes where, you know, running backs do amazing things, but this is incredible. And I watched some clips from him from his days at Penn State. Amazing.
Did you see that one that when he's in the tackling drill, you know, at Penn State, he's at one of his first tackling, and he goes one way, the whole, yeah, everybody goes out, and then he runs around the other way, they can't catch him.
Amazing.
Adam, your thoughts, you and I were talking earlier, I mean, it's, you know, he's a freak if there ever was one in a good way.
He's a special talent. I just hope he can stay healthy. That seems to be the key, because if he stays healthy, I don't see an offense better than this offense in the league right now.
Well, it creates an unparalleled balance that I have yet to see. If we can get Hurts to pick it up in the first quarter, like, could you imagine if
it'll be a blowout every game?
Oh my God! And because it's been real close, guys, where we're down two scores and we're real close to getting blown out ourselves several times, and our defense stood up and again it happened. This past week against Baltimore. But I was saying to Adam, Jeff, having coached a lot of high school football and having seen a kid, and you may know who he is, Kevin Jones. So Kevin played at Cardinal O'Hara. He went to Virginia Tech, and then he was a first-round draft choice for Detroit. Okay, and he only played a handful of years. When he was in high school, he was the same. He was 6 foot 205. He was the number one, you know, fastest kid in the state. I seen him, and I'm telling you the hair on the back of my neck stood up when I seen him. Well, I equate Saquon at that point, because Saquon reminds me of high school running backs that are always one step from going a distance, and eventually they do. This guy's doing it at the pro level. Like, who the hell does that in the NFL?
Right.
I mean, Eric Dickerson did it. You know, Peterson did it in his first few years. I just have rarely.
I mean, there's some quarterbacks that can scramble and do things like that, but this guy's unbelievable.
Yeah, how we got him for? I mean, you know, Howie must be in the back room going, "Can you believe this? This is nuts." for the price of a backup lineman, a half decent lineman. Right.
And you mentioned Eric Dickerson. I just saw today. I had no idea he's on pace to break Dickerson's single season rushing record. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a great time a year. Certainly, we'll see what happens. Hopefully, by like you just said, Adam, please stay healthy. That's the only thing I can say. Jeff, Adam, you talked about you moved into a new place in media where your office is. And, you know, Jeff, you commented, you know, there's some synergy between Adam Barrist and
well, I was saying with a name like Barrist, it's very easy to remember as a lawyer what his name is because it sounds like barrister, right? So the old English attorneys, barristers, are fresh in my mind, and I would never forget a guy like Adam because of his last name.
And so tell us about your new place.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, you mentioned that. My very first deposition, I believe it was 2002, I was so nervous. I had all my notes. And opposing counsel, after I gave my appearance, opposing counsel goes on a diatribe for 2 or 3 minutes about how my name's Barrister and I better be good at this. And never been able to live that down. That was my first deposition. 22 years ago.
Oh, my God.
So in any event, we just bought a new building for our firm, and it's completely fitted out, and we are putting in there a pub, but not just any pub, a full-scale British pub. I should call it a speakeasy because it's not open to the public. It is open to opposing counsel, though, who are giving me a tough time at the deposition table, and afterwards I can maybe persuade them a little better with some of the good stuff.
Well, I'm thinking about having them do that
beforehand. I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, then they won't be on their game so
much. That's right.
But this is going to be an authentic British pub. I've spent a lot of time with my wife in London, and we don't go to fancy restaurants there. We go to pubs. We just enjoy the pub culture. And
that's awesome.
It's going to be called the Barrister, and every person who visits it has to wear the authentic barrister wig that we bought.
Excellent.
From England.
So excellent. I just can't get my mind. So it would be fantastic to have them over before court. They come in, they're sleeping on the other side.
I don't know if I could get away with that. But afterwards, you always see on TV the adversaries who are going at it, and after a deposition or a court proceeding, they go and have a cocktail together. And the reality is that doesn't happen in real life. It doesn't. And I've always sort of...
It workers' compensation.
It does?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How about that?
I'll tell you stories.
Not in my realm, though. And I've always sort of romanticized about that and thought it was cool. And in my experience, it just doesn't happen. So maybe afterwards an adversary or two will join me after a proceeding.
That sounds great. I always tout the workers' compensation section as being the friendliest, most civil section of the bar association that exists. And that's because we get along famously with each other. And it's not to say we minimize the advocacy of our clients, because we don't. We are zealous advocates. But at the end of the day, we're civil, we're human, and we treat each other with dignity and respect. And so after a deposition or a medical expert deposition, or if you're in court and you're finished with court, we'll have lunch or we'll have a drink or whatever. And, you know, we get along famously. And that's what enables us to resolve our cases in a much more amicable fashion than, say, the other sections of the Bar Association.
And I really wish that were the case in the area that I practice, but it doesn't. I mean, I tend to have the same adversaries every single time. It's the same insurance companies, and get along well with them, but can't say I've ever had a cocktail with anyone after proceeding.
It's interesting because is there a reason? I guess the scars of the battle won't allow it. Like, in other words, because I can't. You guys may have. You'll have more insight than I do. But I can't. A lot of plaintiff attorneys have said, you know, they have recruited some members of the other side. You know, and they met obviously when they were competing. They'll be on the show together at from the same firm. Does it get that heated in the courtroom, Adam? That it just gets personal?
I wouldn't say that it gets so heated to that extent. It's just there's not that collegiality as there is in the workers' comp bar. For whatever reason, I don't know what it is, but we just don't have that collegiality.
So let's talk. There's a number of things. Let's first of all, Jeff, remind our listeners about yourself and the firm.
So I handle all workers' compensation claims on behalf of the injured worker. The what we do is we represent injured workers as a result of work-related injuries that cause disabilities, meaning that the injured worker is not able to return to his or her position and as a result needs workers' compensation, which is what you get paid for. And that also entitles you to medical benefits, et cetera. I've been doing this for about 35 years, and I just love what I do. And we have a firm, Gross & Kenny, in Philadelphia, where we are constantly doing workers' compensation claims 24/7.
Across PA and New Jersey?
Or? Across PA and New Jersey, correct.
Adam, if you will, a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. It is 100% plaintiff-side personal injury. I would say a good 80 to 85% of what we do is motor vehicle. The others would be slip and fall and others some miscellaneous cases, wrongful death cases here and there. And I love every second of it. My job takes up 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I will never complain about it. I love it. I have the thankfully the luxury to pick and choose my clients, and you know, it's an important thing to vet your clients from the get-go. But and it's something you get better at as time goes on. But love every second of it.
So let's talk. So personalized, a boutique firm. Mm-hmm. What's the definition? What is a boutique firm?
I would classify a boutique firm as a firm that specializes or focuses in one particular area. As opposed to a jack of all trades firm.
Okay, and when you say that, you know, so let's talk about what clients can expect when both of you represent them. So you're listening to, you know, a lot of people out there. You mentioned people who handle all types of different areas, and in many cases, if they step in your arenas, they become dabblers.
Okay. Dabblers, yeah.
Never a good idea.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You don't want to dabble in something you don't know 100% about, because you're going to end up creating, you could create a problem for your client, and that's, you know, not good.
So if somebody's looking for a workers' compensation firm or somebody to represent them in work comp, they're not familiar with the area, what should they be looking for, Jeff?
I think that they should be looking for a firm that handles only workers' compensation cases, as opposed to, like I said, a jack-of-all-trades type of a firm. General firms generally are, they know a lot about, a little bit about a lot of things. They're not really experts in any one particular area. Workers' compensation actually does have an expert classification. There aren't very many areas of the law where you're considered an expert. And when I say expert, I mean an expert is defined by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania as an area of expertise that the firm or the individual attorney concentrates in, to the point where it's considered an expert, that person's considered an expert. There aren't, like I said, experts in many other areas. If you are a domestic relations attorney, there's no expert in domestic relations. They just have a classification.
Well, why do you think that is? I've heard personal injury attorneys that are really good ones, like Adam, but not Adam in this case, say to me, and this particular individual, a medical malpractice attorney, you did a show with him. He actually said it on your show that he tried briefly or he dabbled in workers' comp, but he got the hell out of it as fast as he could because it's always updating.
It's very complicated. There's a lot of statutory issues, and there's a lot of case law issues that basically expound on the statutes. So unless you are really doing this 24/7 and you have your thumb on the pulse of the latest developments in workers' compensation, it's not something that I would just take on lightly. It occupies three volumes of Purdon's Title 77, which is the workers' compensation statute in Pennsylvania. It's convoluted. There's a lot of annotations to it, so not all of what you're reading in the statute is 100%. There's modifications to it. There's nuances.
How often do you spend update yourself on a new...
Every day.
Really?
Every day. We get updates every day from different things, whether it be... I mean, it's mostly case law, but different interpretations of that case law by various judges. And, you know, I lecture frequently in workers' compensation issues, and I listen and attend CLEs constantly in my area of practice. Unless you're doing that, you're going to miss out on topics and issues, and you could misstep very, very easily. What I wanted to tell you,
please,
though, is that you asked the reason why there's not more expert recognized areas and other areas of the law. And I think it's simply because those areas of the law have not organized themselves yet. They could, but they haven't. And as a result, they have a very few number of classifications. There's a, for instance, there's a specialty in taxation. If you, you could be an expert in taxation, you get your LLM, and you're considered an expert in the area of tax law. Okay, it's recognized by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania for that particular purpose. So you can hold yourself out as an expert in the area of tax law. Workers' comp is another. Personal injury, for some reason, doesn't have an expert classification. It's simply a concentration of practice. And I just believe that's because nobody has really attempted to set forth the steps necessary to make that an expertise.
You think it's also, Adam, because there's so many different areas of personal injury. I mean, you think, you know, you're talking of auto accidents, slip and falls, faulty products. You know, that it's a wide array of you know, potential issues when it comes to personal injury.
So I could not agree more with the sentiment that Jeff just expressed. Okay, workers' comp is a very, very, very specialized area of the law. I will boldly say for any potential claimants out there, you should not go to anybody but a workers' comp attorney if you have a workers' comp scenario. In my realm, there are these jack-of-all-trades. There are some people who handle a little bit of bankruptcy, a little bit of domestic, a little bit of criminal, and a little bit of personal injury. Okay, I will also boldly say that if you are in a car accident, you should not go to anybody but somebody who specializes only in car accidents or slip and fall cases. There are nuances. It is very specialized, and it is very easy for somebody who doesn't know what they're doing to mess up the case. Very easy for that to happen, and it's not just the statute of limitations. There are a lot of other pitfalls.
So here's an interesting, this was shocking. So we did a show with somebody, young lady attorney, and she said she saw a client earlier that day who switched attorneys, ran into a dabbler, a general practice person who probably did wills and estates and some family law and all that stuff. And the first thing that that potential client said to that personal injury attorney was, do I have to pay for the expert again? Okay. There's a whole, you know, slate of issues that you could run into if you run into somebody who, you know, doesn't really do personal injury. They do it on the side. Okay, what should somebody be looking for? Like we asked Jeff about the work comp when they're seeking a personal injury attorney for an auto accident, and you know, or for, you know, one of those other areas. What are some of the things that they should be looking for?
In my humble view, you should, as a client, be asking to have your attorney's cell phone number, his or her email address, and the ability to contact them at all times. I am an extreme type A personality, but I give all of my clients my cell phone number. Okay, I tell them they can contact me whenever they want. I have so many people coming to me saying, so-and-so is my attorney, I only talk to the intake person. Not only can I not get my attorney to talk to me, I can't even get the intake person to talk to me. Will you take over my case? And the answer is almost always no, I cannot take over your case. Unless it's an accident you were involved in a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I am generally not cleaning up the mess of another attorney.
So communications.
Communication. As a client, you should have the ability at all reasonable times to speak to your attorney and get an update on the case. And I've been doing this 22 years, most of that on the plaintiff side, and I very, very, very seldom have a client abuse that. Very seldom.
I could not agree with you more, Adam. First of all, I do the same thing. I give my cell number to all of my clients. It's a very admirable thing that you do that because not many attorneys are that approachable. To my own chagrin, I give out my cell number. My wife probably hates it, but the truth is that people need to know and need to count on their attorney, and if they can't communicate, there's a problem. Communication, in my estimation and in my experience, has always been the key to success. If you can't communicate with other people, you will not be successful. And so if you constantly I don't know, stonewall your clients or don't let them have access to you, but only your staff and the clients can't get an answer to their questions, it creates problems. And that's what creates the first step to, well, I wanted to get a second opinion from another lawyer, or I'm not happy with my lawyer because he or she doesn't get back to me. It's never a good thing.
Before you say a word, because this is important, what I told you before, so we did a show with Adam, okay? First of all, the fact that you both give your, we've thought, Jeff's been doing a show for a couple of years, and he normally gets an odd look when he says, I get my phone number out, right? So Adam, okay, I was thinking about a couple of the shows we did. And one thing that you know, just like you, Jeff, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself, right? Well, you talk about being a type A personality, trust. Okay, that bond, and this when I was thinking about today's show, I thought about this. I'm sure it takes a lot, especially when somebody's injured, especially if they've been beat up by the insurance company, and all those things. They're scared. It takes a decent amount to get that trust with a client. Okay, but it takes about 2 seconds to lose the trust.
Absolutely.
Okay, and when you're saying, okay, you're type A and you like to do it yourself, what you're really saying to me, and I thought about it, is you built that trust factor up. You're not letting anybody else. That's not worth risking to anybody. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
The biggest problem with the trust factor is the concept of attorney-client privilege. Attorney-client privilege is a concept that says that you have an exclusive right to have a conversation with your attorney and have that conversation go nowhere. It doesn't leave that attorney's lips. It doesn't get broadcasted to the community. The other side doesn't know about your communication. If you're not clear in communicating with your clients about that element of trust, then they will constantly not tell you things that are important for their own cases. For instance, they may not tell you that they had a prior accident or a prior injury involving the same body part because they're afraid you may not want to take their case. And they're afraid that, you know, if they tell you that, it might get leaked out somewhere. And if it does, that could ruin their case. So they want to be secure in knowing that they can trust you and that they can trust the process with the attorney-client privilege. And if you don't explain that to them and then create a bond and foster an environment that allows for that attorney-client relationship, which is a special relationship and it's a trust factor, then you will not succeed in the long haul.
Well, I also thought that trust also goes with the communication. If you're not picking the phone up, if they can't get in touch with you, and how long's it? So that trust factor, it's got to be a little bit of a feel out situation, just building that relationship because they're scared. I would venture to say that in both of your areas, vulnerability with a client. You know, a client being vulnerable, probably they've been beat up a little bit, is something that's common by the time they get to you?
Absolutely. So the typical client who I have walk in the door, this is the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to them in their lives. And they want somebody to take care of them, to nurture them, to know that they are going to go to bat for them, they're going to go to war for them if need be. So that is a large aspect of the trust.
So at that point, building that up, and I'm kind of the... I'm in sort of the same way. I would hesitate to put somebody in this seat alone, you know, because you know this is not just about reading 12 questions. You know, it's about, you know, putting some things together. Now, you got the trust of the client. You got, what should insurance companies know about both of you? So and defense attorneys when you walk in, because most people are, you know, the concern that, you know, their attorney's going to, you know, not willing to go to court or something like that.
Right.
What should your insurance and defense attorneys know when you guys walk in a courtroom?
Well, fortunately, and this has taken many years to prove myself to other people, like defense attorneys and judges and insurance companies, you have to develop a reputation based upon your conduct and your behavior. And after a while, people get to know you and get to trust you and get to believe in what you're saying. So you have to convey to them that you're A, reasonable, not unreasonable. Unreasonable requests and unreasonable demands really don't get far. You have to let them know that you're trustworthy in the sense that you're responsible to get back to them when they ask for discovery or they ask for a response to a question. If a judge asks for a response to a question and you are slow to respond to any of those things, you're going to foster a non-trustworthy opponent or a judge. And so you have to convey to them that you are trustworthy in the fact that you're reliable. You're reliable to get back to them. You're reliable. You're giving reliable information. You're not just blowing smoke.
But also in your world, you know, you're going to come prepared on behalf. Like I guess if there's a defense attorney coming tomorrow, I got Jeff Gross tomorrow.
Well, that leads me to my third thing, which is that you have to, you are a man of your word, but you are not a pushover. And so you, when you say you're going to do something, you do something. If you're going to file a penalty petition for failure to get paid on time, you don't just say, well, I'll file one and then not do it. You do it, and you tell the other lawyer, I will be filing a penalty unless my client is paid by this date, and once I file it, I will not withdraw it under any circumstances. So you better be prepared for that. And they have an obligation to notify their client of the communications they have with me. And so if they don't tell their client about this, it's on them. So they know that I'm a man of my word. They know that I do what I say I'm going to do, and the pieces fall in place properly that way.
In your world, Adam, one of the things, it's a small, you know, like a big little city. So a lot of time, you know, I've heard stories where, you know, they're like, well, the insurance companies and the defense attorneys will know who's, you know, who's going to go to court, who's going to go willing to go to court and who's, you know, looking for a quick settlement, you know, and therefore the client may pay for that. Talk about, you know, what they know about you when you walk in.
Sure. So just like I had told you before that I deal with the same adversaries, a lot of times I'm dealing with the same adjusters all the time.
Does that get loud sometimes? you're a pretty professional guy, don't get me wrong.
You have to be. You have to be unless it unless they're behaving in such a manner to, you know, to be very excited. That right. doesn't happen all the time. But typically speaking, I'm dealing with the same 7 or 8 insurance companies. I'm dealing with, you know, the same 15 to 20 adjusters from each insurance company. So they need to know that I'm not going to accept a lowball offer. Okay. In order for them to know that, they have to know that I'm going to decline their $5,000 offer on a case involving 3 different herniations, which is, you know, could be worth $75,000, could be worth $175,000, depends on how much work they miss, depends on a lot of things. Could be worth less if there's a limited tort issue, but won't get into that now. But just like Jeff said, you have to act on your promises. You can't make empty promises at all. So typically in what I do, and this is not appropriate for every case, but a lot of my cases, the catastrophic ones, you need to have a time limit demand. And I always have time limit demands. But if they come back with a lowball offer to a time limit demand, I will send a subsequent letter that says, if you do not offer X by Y date, I am going to file suit and please put your insured on notice that I intend to execute upon their personal assets upon a judgment in excess of your policy limit. So, you know, real world example, say my client was rear-ended and broke 3 different bones, have 5 herniated discs and was out of work for 4 weeks, and there's a $250,000 policy. I would demand a tender of that $250,000. They might come back and say, we're offering $100,000. I would say, no, you have until X date to give me the $250,000. And if they do not meet that deadline, and talk about type A personality, I have the complaint prepared. I will be filing that complaint electronically, either in the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas, Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas, United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, or elsewhere. I will have that time stamped, and I will have that delivered to you the very next morning with the timestamp on that date. And a lot of times after that, they'll give me the, whoa, can't we talk about it? No, we can't talk about this.
We already talked about it.
We talked about it. You had a time limit demand. Now, sir or madam, put your insured on notice that once I get a judgment in excess of your policy limits, I am going to go after their personal assets, and it's your fault for not taking my time limit demand seriously. So they have to know that you're serious, and you have to make good on all those promises. They can't be threats. They have to be actual promises that you make good on.
Amen.
And, yeah, I feel like I'm talking to the same guy, actually. It's amazing. I we're from Philadelphia here, okay, and knowing your clients, okay, the culture here. Now you rep Jeff. You represent individuals from across Jersey and from across PA. But how important is it for you to know the culture of, you know, you talk about juries, okay, and we're going to get into that in a second before we talk about potential cases where, you know, third-party cases, but how important is it to understand your clients and you know, you know, they'll talk about in personal injury that you understand nobody want, the insurance companies don't want a Philly jury, okay? But they also, and they'll know the counties. Everybody understands, really, you know, quality attorneys understand what county they're in and the different risks and all that. However, how about in your world when you have a client, an injured worker from Lancaster and one from Philly? How important is it for you to understand kind of the culture from where they're at?
It's so important. It's a relationship like anything else, and it's breathable, meaning you have relationships that are constantly evolving. And so when you demonstrate an ability to represent somebody to your word, as Adam put it, you have to make good on that. And when you talk to a client, you need to get to know your client. If you don't get to know your client, what ends up happening is you have one expectation, your client has another expectation. You have to match your expectation with your client's expectation. You have to be on the same page, and you have to communicate with your client about what you're doing. But it's really important, like you said in the beginning, to get trust. And so I always have conversations with my clients about them, about what's going on in their lives, how they're doing, what other things are going on in their lives, because not everybody sees life through the same eyes that you do. And so you don't know what you don't know.
Is it important for both of you to understand what's going on in somebody's life in regards to these insurance companies want to smoke them out, okay? What type of stress they're in, what type of situation. But even though in some cases you may say, listen, you have a bad injury, we have to stick this out if we're gonna get you a recovery that will give you dignity for the rest of your life, right? Okay. Well, how important is it, Adam, to understand their situation?
It's very important. And from the get-go, I tell the client, this case is not going to be ripe for settlement for at least 5-6 months. Okay, doesn't matter how badly injured you are. There's certain examples. Say there's a $15,000 policy and, you know, somebody's paralyzed, God forbid. But in 99% of the cases out there, I am telling the client from the get-go, I cannot even put this in for settlement for 5 or 6 months. And the reason for that is your prognosis is not going to be known until 5 or 6 months. It's just not going to be known. So I cannot put this in for settlement until 5 or 6 months. That being said, at the 5 or 6 month mark, my paralegal is coming to me with a list of cases. Okay, call this client and find out what they're doing. Are they done treating? Are they continually treating? 75% of the time at that 5-6 month mark, they will tell me that they have done 5-6 months of physical therapy. They've gotten their MRIs. They've gotten their EMGs. They've gotten injections. And at that point, we compile the records. We put it in for settlement. But it's important to let them know from the get-go that I'm not putting in your case for settlement 2 months in. You are not going to get full value on this case, and you're selling yourself short. So that's a conversation I have at the beginning of every single case.
And so, you know, we've talked a little bit about the different situations where a personal injury attorney who handles a large portion of car accidents would work with a workers' compensation attorney. Let's talk about that scenario, okay? Because I'm sure, I think my wife and I, I'll tell you what, we were driving up to New Hope for Thanksgiving. And I was on 95, and I was going 60 miles an hour, right? The cars were driving by me. I just wanted to relax and just drive, you know. That was impossible, okay? These young jitterbugs are going 95, 100 miles an hour. I said to my wife, I got to get in the game or I'm going to actually get run over. My point is, you know, it's so treacherous out there at times, okay? You're driving for a living, okay? And I can't imagine what that's like. Okay, because you're doing it at rush hour, different. Let's talk about that potential scenario first. And this is interesting, Jeff. We were talking about Uber drivers, okay, and Lyft drivers. Now, I'm real experienced at my legal background, so I'm going to say they should get workers' compensation right off the bat, and we're all good, right? Or no?
Well, Uber drivers don't get workers'
exactly.
compensation.
Exactly. Adam just said
at
that.
At least not yet.
Well, and my point is, so and it's a, you know, getting into the auto insurance conversation along with that, that's a totally different ballgame. They're subcontractors. They're categorized. That's a whole show. But if I'm working for, I'm delivering a delivery service or something like that, okay, and I get T-boned, okay. Now we're in a situation where the auto insurance, you know, is a part of the whole thing. Where do we go? They just came into your office, Jeff.
So you have to be an employee to get workers' compensation, which is why Uber drivers do not get workers' compensation. They're independent contractors. So therefore, they don't qualify under the employee-employer relationship. However, if you're a delivery driver for a company and you're delivering a product and you get T-boned, as you put it, by a Mack truck, let's just say, then, yeah, they're employees. They're entitled to workers' compensation to the extent that they can't work or they have a loss of earning capacity, and they're entitled to get their medical bills paid for whatever they need as a result of the accident. However, in addition to the workers' compensation claim, which is one case, they also have another case. They're two separate cases combined into one from the same transaction and occurrence that arises out of the same event, which is the car accident, against the third party, which in the law, it's no such thing as number three. The third party simply means other. And so you can't sue your employer for negligence. You can make a negligence claim against a third party that is not your employer. So that driver of the Mack truck and his or her company that he's employed with, you can sue that company for, as a third party, for negligence as a result of this accident. And then you recover the elements, the same elements that you would recover from the workers' compensation claim, although you would also recover an additional element, which is the non-economic damage component of that claim, otherwise known as what's colloquially referred to as pain and suffering. And it's not just pain and suffering. It's a whole laundry list of non-economic damages that really are elements and damages that I can't readily quantify and calculate. For instance, economic damages are damages like your medical bills, your lost wages, your future needs for medical treatment and those bills, your future lost wages. Those are all calculable things. But what I can't calculate, and this is part of the non-economic damage claim, is your pain, your suffering, your loss of life's pleasures, your mental anguish, your humiliation. I could give you a laundry list of all kinds of damages that are nebulous terms that don't have an ability to be quantified readily. They have to be negotiated. And that's where Adam would come in. And that aspect of that third-party claim can only be had against a third party, meaning an other party than the employer.
So, Adam, you get the call from Jeff. He's had a situation where somebody driving for a delivery company was T-boned. First thing I'd like to ask you is, I don't think I've ever asked this probably simple question, and we talk about auto insurance, okay? The difference between full tort, limited tort, which a lot of us have never heard of. I just think I got full coverage. I know you've never heard that before, right?
Never heard that term.
Exactly.
That is the bane of my existence, that term.
Right, exactly.
It is an urban legend.
Right. And so thus my sarcasm, but also uninsured, underinsured. When somebody owns a company, okay, we know they need workers' compensation, but is there minimums in regards to what they need to cover their auto, automobiles or their trucks? In other words, are they required to have a specific amount of auto insurance available for their own employees?
They are. So there are different thresholds for different companies. So we were talking about different industries, excuse me. We were talking before about limited torque, full torque. That generally doesn't come into play if you're driving a commercial vehicle. Okay, and I see that a lot with truck drivers, 18-wheeler drivers, who may have limited torque on their Honda Civic, but when they're driving the rig, they are not subject to the limited torque threshold. We can get into that if you want. But there are different thresholds for different industries as to what you need. In Pennsylvania, if you have a personal vehicle, the minimum amount of insurance you're required to have, incredibly, is $15,000. So if you are driving around and you go and paralyze somebody, you are only required to be insured up to $15,000. So the person who you just paralyzed, they will only be able to get $15,000.
Can they sue you personally?
They can sue you personally. Yes, they can, but that's usually not a winning strategy because, quite candidly, if you have, and I'm generalizing here, but if you have a $15,000 policy, you probably do not have anything to go after. So that's why it's so important that everybody have uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage to protect yourself from the knucklehead who hit you, who either has no insurance or minimal insurance. And a lot of times it's no insurance at all. It's not even the $15,000.
Okay, so you get the call from Jeff. It's a work situation. Okay. And they've been T-boned, okay? It's absolutely negligence. Where do you go from there?
Sure. So I first say thank you, Jeff, for sending me this case. Can you please give me the workers' compensation adjuster's claim number and their contact information so that I can put them on notice? Because as opposed to another case that's not workers' comp related, they are entitled to assert a lien against the proceeds of the third-party case. Not to complicate this too much, but simply speaking, if you're in a non-commercial vehicle, the person who hits you is in a non-commercial vehicle, your medical bills are going to get paid for by your auto carrier up to $5,000. In some cases, it's more, but 95% of the people in the state have $5,000 in medical coverage. Okay, if you're work comp, that's totally different.
There is no limit.
There is no limit, but they will pay your bills, and Jeff will force them to pay all of your bills. And when they say they're not going to pay your bills, Jeff is going to fight them and make sure they do pay your bills. However, as opposed to in a case not involving workers' compensation, the workers' compensation carrier can and will always assert a lien against the proceeds.
Subrogation
against the third-party case, which sounds like a bad thing, but it's really not a bad thing because, quite candidly, it increases the value of the third-party case because they know when they settle the claim, they have to pay not just your pain and suffering, your economic losses, but also this huge work comp lien that you may
have. So when you get this call, okay, let's just say it's a month. You know, you didn't get it right away, Jeff, and I'm sure that's a normal thing. Somebody got beat up a little bit that, you know, they asked the owner of the company who they go to. Mm-hmm. They went through all that misleading information. Now they're a month down the road. Mm-hmm. Now you have to get that call. Where's the investigation start for you?
Okay. I get those calls a lot. So ideally, I get a call, you know, the day of the accident, a couple of days after the accident, and I say, are you injured? Where are your injuries? Okay, go to the emergency room. Go to the emergency room right now. The reality is sometimes you get those calls 2 weeks later. Sometimes you get those calls a month later because people just don't have the wherewithal. They think, I can't afford this. I don't have insurance. I don't have medical insurance. Whether or not you have medical insurance is of no consequence in a car accident case. Because if you are under work comp, if you are executing your job functions, work comp will pay your bills. Say you don't have medical insurance, which a very substantial portion of the population in this country does not have. Now, if you have car insurance in the state of Pennsylvania, you are covered a minimum of $5,000 in what I call free medical coverage. And I call it free medical coverage because no copays, no deductibles, no nothing, and they cannot subsequently assert a lien against it. So they will pay your $5,000, or sometimes other cases it's $10,000, other cases it's $25,000, depending on what your policy calls for. And they are not entitled to get that money back out of the proceeds of your case. So a lot of people just don't get medical treatment because they think they're not covered when in actuality they're paying for this car insurance and they are covered.
Well, when you have a third-party case, where does the is communication important with the attorneys, and how can each one of your responsibilities impact the other?
You don't need to double your efforts, and I usually pave the way for a guy like Adam, because I will take care of the damage element up front. In other words, my clients will treat and go to the doctors and get their various and sundry diagnostic studies, and if they need a surgery or injections or therapy, whatever the modalities are, I make sure that that's all done, and I make sure that it's all nicely packaged for Adam. And basically what will happen is I will get all that stuff put together, and then we'll send everything to Adam so that he has it for his file, and he can simply, it's no different than a handoff in football, right? I'm actually handing off the claim to him, and he can run with the third-party claim. The third-party claims generally are on the heels of the workers' compensation claim. You want to try to resolve the workers' compensation claim first, because by making a settlement or resolving the workers' compensation claim, you're creating a finite lien that's going to allow Adam to have a lien, or subrogation lien is what we were talking about, against his third-party case that will increase the value of that third-party case exponentially.
How can your actions impact Adams, especially in regards to settling a case? I've heard a number of situations where you have an inexperienced person handling the work comp, and they don't know and settle. Course. And talk about that element, why you need a workers' compensation attorney that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, but communication is what you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
If I don't communicate with Adam and don't tell him what's going on in the workers' comp claim, he could end up making a settlement for far less than what the potential value of that third-party claim is, because he doesn't have the requisite information, all the bills and the lien and all that stuff. When I'm done with my case, everything gets shipped to Adam in the sense that he will have the medical records, he will have the total amount of the medical expenses, the total amount of the outlay of wage loss expenses, i.e. the workers' compensation lien, and he'll be able to use that to his advantage in showing the third-party adjuster for that insurance company what the value of the claim is, and showing that carrier what their exposure is. Exposure being that key word here.
The ebbs and flows of the different types of cases. So work comp settle faster than PI?
Well, in an ideal world, yes. There are circumstances where the workers' compensation case can't settle. If I have a paraplegic, and there's no way that I can settle the claim and get this person what he or she needs for the rest of his life, I would be doing this person an injustice in many cases by settling those cases in advance of the third-party case, because it would set this client up for failure. You want to protect the client. You want to make sure that the client has access to ongoing medical expenses or ongoing wage loss if need be, and then get that third-party case, which it's not necessarily gravy, but it's what the true value of the claim is under the law. And if I don't set my client up for future medical going forward, I should not be settling the case, and especially not subsequent to the third-party case. If Adam settles his case first, what ends up happening is if it's for a large amount of money and it exceeds the workers' compensation lien, we have something called a holiday grace period that the insurance company gets to stop payment for the wage loss that they have been providing to my client for a period of time until it catches up with the value of that third-party case. And I'm sure that's happened to Adam from time to time. But I will tell you that that is the backwards way of settling it, to have that third-party case settle first. When, if at all possible, you want to settle the workers' comp claim first to maximize the combination.
Does that happen the majority of the time?
Yes.
Adam, when there's a workers' compensation element, these cases, like I know you walked us through a little bit of a timetable of 5-6 months, mm-hmm. but typically on a work injury, I'm assuming it's a little bit, it's longer. But some of these cases, the insurance companies aren't just, bending over and sending over a check, right? Even though it may be an obvious negligent situation. Talk about that first conversation sure. you have with somebody to let them know the ebbs and flows, number one, because this could take some time, okay, in spite of what happened at Starbucks or McDonald's with the coffee. But also the fact that with a workers' compensation situation, you got a good attorney like Jeff, you know, they may be able to get their lost wages while they're going through this, which takes some stress off the situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what Jeff said is absolutely true. The work comp matter, in most scenarios, will be wrapped up with a bow and handed to me so that I can pursue my third-party case. The times that I see it not work out that way is if the client is catastrophically injured and there's a minimal policy or, you know, not a seven-figure policy, and the other side just wants to tender up the policy and that's it. And in that situation, you know, I would have to accept that tender because that's all the insurance there is. And that grace period that Jeff was talking about, that comes into play. That doesn't happen all the time, though. But client expectations are very, very important. It's important the client know from the very, very beginning what I can do for them, but more importantly, what I can't do for them. I see this in the context of dog bites. I handle quite a few dog bite cases. And these are very sad cases, and they seem to be getting worse and worse and worse. And I am an animal lover. I am a dog owner. And but it doesn't change the fact that a lot of people don't know how to handle their dogs these days. And 95% of my cases, I'm dealing with a pit bull or the German Shepherd. So a lot of times someone will get bitten very badly. A lot of times it involves a child, and it's awful. Some of these photos I've seen are god awful, and these people are disfigured for the rest of their lives. They don't just want money. They want a pound of flesh, no pun intended. They want the dog to be put to sleep. They want criminal charges a lot of times to be levied, to be brought against the dog owner. And what I tell them from the outset is I don't put dogs to sleep. I cannot get the authorities to put the dog to sleep, and I cannot have criminal charges brought against it. And this comes up a lot in car accident cases too. This person was driving. This person hit me from behind at 55 miles an hour. And they don't bring criminal charges. And, you know, what I tell them from the outset is I am not the police. I am not the district attorney. I cannot bring criminal charges. And I need to let you know from the beginning that I can do one thing and one thing alone for you. Well, I can do two things. I can return your phone calls. I can return your text messages. I can return your emails. And I can get you money. Those are the things that I can do. And I can fight zealously for you. Go to bat for you, fight like hell for you. What I can't do is I cannot get a district attorney's office to prosecute the person.
Or often speed up the insurance company's timetable on, like you mentioned earlier, you're not going to know until there's some sort of an idea of how sick or how hurt they are.
I can do that to a certain extent in that I can tell them that 5 or 6 month mark, we're putting this case in for settlement. It is not what Adam thinks this case is worth. I can only guide you accordingly. But if you tell me, Adam, I'm not settling this case for less than $20 billion, I'm going to tell you you're crazy. They're offering you $250,000. Take it. But I can't force you to take it. What I can do is I can file a lawsuit and push the issue. So the insurance companies are big. The insurance companies are mighty. But they don't hold all the cards. We have the ability as attorneys to file lawsuits on behalf of our clients.
Let's do this. We only have 2 minutes left, and certainly this so much we're leaving on the table, which we'll save for another time. If you would, Adam, remind our listeners a little bit, your contact information if they want to get in touch.
Sure. So our website is barristfirm.com. Phone number is 215-432-8829. Or if you want to use a 610 number in Delaware County, it's 610-580-0300. Email address is abarrist@barristfirm.com. And we'd love to talk to you about your car accident case, your slip and fall case, your dog bite case. You will speak to an attorney. You will not speak to an intake person.
Fantastic. Jeff Gross, if you will.
Best place to get me is on my cell phone. Just like Adam was saying, he gives out his cell phone. Mine is 215-512-1500. And that is the best place to get me. It's very easy to remember, 215-512-1500. Call me. I will be on the other side.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I want to obviously thank Jeff Gross, our host, for a fantastic broadcast. Obviously, want to thank Adam Barrist of the Barrist Firm for being our guest on the broadcast. And, of course, I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the Jeff Gross Show here on WWDB Talk 860. On behalf of our panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.